This is WFAE News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Emma, email marketing and automation software featuring specialized editions for organizations like universities, agencies, and franchises. Emma, email marketing for the modern brand. Learn more at myemma.com.
Support comes from WFAE members and Business North Carolina magazine, covering the economy, industry, and business of North Carolina each month. July focuses on the state's top economic development projects. Subscriptions online at businessnc.com and at the App Store.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When the Continental Congress, meeting in Philadelphia in the summer of 1776, decided they had reached an impasse in relations with King George in England, they felt it necessary to declare the reasons for their decision to separate from the mother country. The result is a famous document released on July 4th of that year, the Declaration of Independence. The people of Mecklenburg County were similarly moved to declare their independence from the British Crown, but they reached their decision a year earlier, on May 20th, 1775, 239 years ago. They, too, wrote out a Declaration of Independence, or so legend would have it. But is it more than a legend? A debate has been quietly, sometimes not so quietly, raging about that since our country was in its infancy, and it continues to this day. Now there's a book laying out the arguments for the authenticity of that document, as well as some of the arguments that put it in dispute. The book, The First American Declaration of Independence, The Disputed History of the Mecklenburg Declaration of May 20th, 1775, was written by our guest this hour. Scott Seifert is a corporate attorney and co-founder of the May 20th Society. That's a nonprofit dedicated to commemorating the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. Scott is also one of the people responsible for creating the Liberty Walk. That's a Center City tour of historic sites from the American Revolution. He was here last to talk about that, so welcome back. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
You spent 10 years of your young life.
Not as young as it used to be, but yeah.
On researching and writing this book.
Yes.
That's a lot of time. A lot of effort went into this.
It was a lot of time and it was a lot of effort, but it was fun. You know, I don't have any hobbies. I don't play golf. So this was what I did. It was, and I started it, as you mentioned, we started the May 20th Society 10 years ago. Uh-huh. And for the purpose of bringing back what was this huge Charlotte commemoration that had really kind of faded away and almost been forgotten about 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So a group of young professionals, you know, some real estate guys, some lawyers, some bankers, we all got together and said, this is kind of a cool story. Why don't we bring it back? And that really tapped into a lot of energy in Charlotte, and a lot of people were very excited about that. And that got the group going, and you know, we funded the statue of James Jack over at Central Piedmont Community College.
It's right down there on, Kings Drive?
Exactly.
Right at the Greenway.
Right at the Greenway.
I thought it was Paul Revere.
Well, you know, and it's great. It's funny you mention that. So everyone walks by and they're like, why is this statue of Paul Revere in Charlotte?
Yeah.
And that, in a way, was the impetus for the book, because there wasn't a book that told the story of James Jack, or like, who is this guy? Why is there a statue to this guy? What is this story? There was no book out there that covered all this. So in my work at the May 20 Society, we get questions from the media or from others, you know, asking, who is James Jack? How do you know this is true? You know, what are the counterarguments? And for whatever reason, I became the regimental historian.
Okay.
So I gathered all the information. I ran down the leads, and I looked up about 6 years ago, and I had all this stuff, all this information that I've done. And I thought, you know, I need to write this down, because if I get hit by a car, you know, this will all disappear again. And so that really was the motivation to sort of, you know, codify it and fill the space that was missing.
There's going to be a celebration today at Trade and Tryon at noon with, I'm told, a parade and historical readings. And you're doing a thing at the BB&T ballpark tonight at the Knights game. And one of my, Wendy Herkey, our producer, says that the Bobcats are changing their name to the Hornets today at 12:30, and she attributes that to the celebration. Is that what it is, you think? Do you think they timed it to coordinate with MECDEC Day?
I don't know that, but it seems completely logical, yeah. Right? Because the Hornets is it's a Revolutionary War
term. Yeah, we were a hornet's nest of activity.
That's right.
But you mentioned that the celebration had been bigger in the past, and I was surprised to discover, thanks to you, that Presidents Taft, Wilson, Eisenhower, and Ford, others, came here to celebrate MECDEC Day on May 20th in different years. And they taught this. It was mandatory to be taught in the schools, the public schools in North Carolina, but no more.
Exactly.
What happened?
See, and that's to me the most fascinating part of the story, which is this was a big deal in North Carolina. In fact, it was sort of the biggest
deal. Well, it's on the flag.
They put the date May 20th on the state flag. It's on the state seal. It is when they built the Washington Monument, they'd ask every state to contribute one brick that represented what their state stood for. And the brick that North Carolina contributed says Declaration of Independence, May 20th, 1775. So that sort of tells you how important it was. It was a city and county holiday until the early 80s. You know, my mom tells me she spent many years in the town that they didn't celebrate Memorial Day. The 4th of July was sort of just another holiday, but May 20th was a big deal. So, and as you point out, we had four sitting American presidents come to Charlotte to celebrate MECDEC Day, you know, as recently as Gerald Ford in 1975. And then all of it kind of fades away. It just disappears, not overnight.
But why?
Well, a couple reasons. It just kind of lost its cachet. You know, Charlotte, you know this better than anybody else, but 30 years ago said we are going to be a forward-looking new South city, right? We're going to have big buildings. We are going to look to the future. We're going to get away from all the negative connotations of the past and recent history. And Charlotte was very effective at that. And then you had a lot of transplants come to Charlotte. A lot of people had never been here before. And I think the story just got... You know, it just kind of lost its edge. People said, you know, it's Revolutionary War. It's old guys reading old documents. There's a controversy about whether it happened or not. Mm-hmm. We find it all a little quaint, maybe a little embarrassing. And it just, you know, for better or worse, it just dissipated.
The story is the controversy.
The story is the controversy.
So let's talk about it.
Sure.
The Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence was allegedly written and signed all in one day on one piece of paper 239 years ago today in 1775. Why is its existence still shrouded in mystery and controversy?
The very short answer is because the original document was lost in a fire in April of 1800.
How do we know that it was lost in a fire in April of 1800?
Great question, because the Sun...
assumes that it existed.
So we can start with that. So the secretary of the convention was a guy named John McNitt Alexander. Uh-huh. He was a very upstanding, reputable citizen here in town. And his home burned... in April of 1800, and with his home was lost whatever the original records of the convention existed. Now, all of that is true. You can say, well, we don't know what records there were. We don't know that the MECDEC was part of those records, but it's not in dispute that whatever papers he may have had were lost, the originals.
Right.
So that's the controversy in a nutshell.
And we know, I don't know that we know this. Let me ask you.
I'll tell you.
Thank you. That's why you're here.
Exactly.
You start the book with John McNitt Alexander from his home in Alexandriana to Charlotte. Where is Alexandriana?
Alexandriana, when McNitt Alexander lived there, was one of the largest plantation homes in North Carolina. It even appears on place maps alongside cities like Salisbury and Concord. Mm-hmm. You have Alexandriana. Mm-hmm. And it's still – there's now a small county park. And it's up old Statesville Road, about 10 miles north of town. And now, you have Alexander Middle School, mm-hmm. you have Alexander on a road, you have all these connotations to that family. But they were the leading family in the region. You know, Hezekiah Alexander was his brother. His home is now the Charlotte History Museum.
And he was he was one of the leaders of the militia. There were, several divisions of militia to protect the area. And he was called to come to Charlottesburg or Charlottetown, whatever they called it back then.
Somebody called it, right.
For a meeting of militia leaders.
That's right.
And you begin your book by his riding into town. And we'll get to that. I want to have you share some of the description of that ride. But we know that. How do we know that he was called, and how do we know that he came on that day 239 years ago today?
So everything we know about this subject at all comes from the fact that various witnesses, or two sources, various witnesses, many, many years after the fact, write their accounts of what happened that day. And they do this about 1830-ish. And all of their accounts, and there's 13 witnesses, and they're all very credible witnesses. They are Presbyterian ministers. They are Revolutionary War soldiers, and very prominent ones.
And these are people who came for this meeting?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And only two are direct participants in the meeting, but others were sort of there or around or said, you know, I was there, I saw this. And their accounts are all, with some minor irregularities, all pretty similar. And they all name the same people, more or less, being involved. John McNitt Alexander, Hezekiah Alexander, Ephraim Brevard. So that's the sort of big bucket.
All the names of our streets.
All the names. That's the easiest way to remember. Davidson, right? Yeah, Brevard, Caldwell, all the names of the streets. Those are why we have the street names.
Right.
So what we know from these people saying this 45 years later. We also know, because it's commonly believed that all the papers are lost in a fire. That's not exactly true. There are, in fact, a couple fragmentary papers or papers that are sort of scattered other places, but they're all anonymous or undated or torn in half. So they don't prove, if you want to believe the story, they don't prove the story. Now, they mean something, and what credibility one gives to them depends on one's position in the argument.
Now, this is a very complicated story.
It's a complicated story.
We're going to have to hopscotch around it.
Right,
but
that's fine.
In his declaration, Thomas Jefferson wrote that when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for the people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impelled them to the separation. How do you explain that Mecklenburg County residents reached that same conclusion, decided that they too needed to make a declaration of their independence, but they needed to do it a year before the Continental Congress got around to it?
Right, and that's a great question about the controversies. How would this possibly happen a year before? You know, was the county or the country really ready to even be independent? And answer that, you've got to look at the people who lived here. So these are Scotch-Irish Presbyterians, and these are not— these guys are more Presbyterian than the Presbyterians. You know, I describe them as almost a militant splinter group of Presbyterians. They're very anti-English, very anti-English. They have a series of grievances, and we know this because they write various petitions to the governor in the 1760s saying, you know, we're stopping paying taxes, we should not have to have Anglican ministers here. And they're led by—
they resented having to contribute to the Church of England
because they were—
Exactly. Presbyterian.
That's right. Yeah. And if you wanted to be married, you had to have an Anglican minister come or marry you. Right, and there weren't any Anglican ministers here, so you'd have to go find one, pay for them, and you'd have to wait. So it was all these things that they just didn't like, which is why they were living in this region in the first place. You know, they were getting away from British authority and British rule. They wanted to be as far away as they could. So when you have these sorts of folks here, and then they receive, and of course the story is they receive word of the battles of Lexington and Concord have happened. A writer comes into town and says, you know, this has happened, and they all are outraged, and that sort of triggers this a very emotional response. In fact, McNitt Alexander writes, you know, we smelt and felt the blood and carnage of Lexington, which raised all the passions into fury and revenge, and something happens. So then the question is, what is that something?
So why did they call this meeting on this day 239 years ago? Was it specifically to write a Declaration of Independence?
No.
Was it to talk about defending this area from the British? What was it?
The story is they were having the meeting anyway. Colonel Thomas Polk, who's sort of the founder of Charlotte and the leader of the militia, had summoned a meeting so that the local leaders could talk about, you know, all the crises in the American colonies that were then ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
For example, our Governor Bull of South Carolina describes the colonies as, in quote, a state of general frenzy, close quote. So everyone knows that war is imminent. Everyone is up in arms about the British generally, even before Lexington and Concord, right? You've got the Siege of Boston. You have all these things going on. So everybody's all upset. So they were having a meeting in any event, goes the story, when the rider arrives and triggers this response.
The rider who tells them about—
the express rider who rides into Charlotte delivering the news of Lexington and Concord.
So that tips the scale.
That tips the scale.
And they decided to write this declaration.
That's
Did
correct.
King George, was it ever delivered to King George?
Our declaration?
Yes.
No. Well, no, not that we know of. I mean, there's a lot of missing parts to this, but no, there's no record of that.
This is a long and complicated but darn interesting story. Scott Seifert has put it all in his book, The First American Declaration of Independence, The Disputed History of the Declaration of May 20th, 1775, and we are coming right back.
Hope you're enjoying this rebroadcast edition of Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Honda of Concord, committed to customer service, satisfaction, and bringing excellence to the car buying experience, offering a selection of over 700 new and pre-owned vehicles. Details at hondaofconcord.com. Public opinion on the question of whether same-sex couples should be allowed to wed legally has changed dramatically over the last decade. The couples can now wed legally in all 50 states after the recent Supreme Court ruling, but a North Carolina law allows magistrates the right to refuse to marry same-sex couples based on religious objections. We'll have a conversation about the impact of the Supreme Court ruling here in North Carolina and find out what's next for gay rights advocates. That's when Charlotte Talks, Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, for this 4th of July, a fresh reading of the Declaration of Independence and why our founding document may be as much about equality as it is about freedom.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Scott Seifert is with us, an attorney by trade, but he slogged for 10 years through primary and secondary research to write this book, The First American Declaration of Independence, which was allegedly written and signed on this day 239 years ago. I asked you just before the break about King George, if he ever saw this document, because the whole purpose of any declaration of independence from the British Crown was to show it to the British Crown and say, hey, we're done with you, right?
Right, exactly. So it is not known if King George saw the declaration. Mm-hmm. It is known that the Earl of Dartmouth, who is the cabinet minister responsible for the American colonies, got a report that this had happened. And we know that because in June of 1775, the last royal governor, a guy named Josiah Martin, mm-hmm. writes a letter to the Earl of Dartmouth in which he says, the resolves of the Committee of Mecklenburg, which your lordship will find in the enclosed newspaper, surpass all the horrid and treasonable publications that the inflammatory spirits of this continent have yet produced. So he saw something. Now, what was that newspaper? What was in it? Was it the resolves? Was it the MECDEC? Was it something else? That we don't know. But we do know that the British at a very high level saw something.
Now, we do know, and there's no dispute, mm-hmm. about the existence of the Mecklenburg Resolves. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's exactly right.
And the Mecklenburg Resolves are what?
So the Mecklenburg Resolves, let me step back a second and put it in context. So everyone, all these historians are arguing in the early 19th century about whether there was a Mecklenburg Declaration or not. Mm-hmm. And John Adams and Jefferson write letters back and forth about this, which we can talk about. But then all the historians become very animated. It becomes a national controversy. It's sort of the Rosetta Stone, Da Vinci Code argument of the early 19th century. And so a historian working in Charleston finds in 1838, finds in a June 1775 newspaper, these resolutions. They're resolutions from Charlottetown. They are dated May 31st, so not May 20th. And they're clearly legitimate.
And right? Who would have written those?
Well, that's a great question. So they are signed by Ephraim Brevard, but they're written on the Committee of Mecklenburg. So we don't know who wrote them. We know Brevard signed them. Now, Brevard is also associated.
And who was he in terms of being an official?
Ephraim Brevard is one of the leading patriot leaders in the community. He's thought to have been one of the guys who wrote the MECDEC too.
But unelected.
Yeah, unelected.
Prominent person with influence.
Exactly. Okay. A lot of these guys are elected by their local folks to be magistrate, and he's one of those sort of guys. So they find the Mecklenburg Resolves. All right, so there are 20 resolves, but they don't read or look like what the MECDEC is supposed to look like. They sort of say, now that we're independent of Britain, Mike, you're in charge of gunpowder. We're going to have court every other month. If you spit in the street, it's a 3-shilling fine. They don't say we're free and independent.
So
we declare independence.
It's essentially their constitution to run the city and the county.
That's what it looks like. Okay. So the Mecklenburg Resolves, or the May 31st Resolves, have an interesting effect on this whole debate because they don't change anybody's mind. So if you believe the story of MECDEC, you say, well, this is entirely consistent with the story, right? On May 20th, they pass a Declaration of Independence. 11 days later, they passed this, these Mecklenburg resolves. And they are clearly setting up a government. You know, so this is consistent with the whole story. Mm-hmm. If you're a skeptic, however, this is the hammer you now have to beat the story to death or try to. Because you say, look, we understand there's witnesses. There's all this circumstantial evidence. We get it. We're not disputing it. But what happened was all these old guys, they all remember these resolves. And they conflate in their own mind that this was a Declaration of Independence. And you don't have the Declaration, so we don't know what it really said. But this is all that really happened. And these are cool. They're interesting, you know, but big deal.
Yeah.
A lot of counties had anti-British resolutions, and that's all those are. So that is, in fact, that's the argument today by the skeptics.
You talk not only about the fact that there is controversy, but you talk about how the controversy is really passionate. There are people on both sides who are diehard in their beliefs about this, and
that's
will
right.
defend them to the death. I'm just curious, what's at stake here? Why do contemporary people in the 21st century really care whether or not this declaration was ever written? I know that they want the truth. They would like to see evidence if they don't believe it, and those who do believe it would like to also see that same evidence to certify their claims. But they're really diehard. I mean, they're really passionate
that's
why.
People are focused. I mean, when people are into this story, and on either side, too. And I'll give you an example. When I wrote the manuscript, I sent to a very prominent university publishing house and had some contacts there. And the response I got was, we would never publish a book on this subject. You know, this is beneath us. This is, you know, this is, we can't touch this. No one would allow it.
Well, academic historians really don't like this.
And I had to explain, look, this is not I gave you 400 pages to prove it. I mean, it isn't that book. And it's not that here's 700 footnotes to disprove it. My goal was to say, look, here's all the evidence. You guys are grown-ups. All we can write about is what's true, and everybody make their own mind up.
So you are an enthusiast. You are somebody who believes in the MECDEC. You want to see MECDEC Day continued and brought back to its full glory.
That's right.
You spent 10 years doing research. Given your bias, how can we trust your findings?
Well, it's a fair question. It's a fair question. Well, the answer is I'm an attorney, first and foremost.
How can we trust
your findings? Yeah, exactly. And a politician. No, that's – and I'm in the media. No, it's a fair question. Well, look, my goal was to set out all the evidence, and I think any reasonable, fair-minded person, if you look at it, you can say there's a lot of evidence. Now, you can read the book, and you can look at all the evidence, and you can conclude, I still don't believe it. And I know people, some local professors and friends of mine who say, you know, I think it's a cute story, I think it's interesting, but I don't buy it. You can also reasonably come to the other conclusion that, yeah, I've looked at the evidence, there's something to this.
Well, you say that there's a lot of circumstantial evidence surrounding the existence of this document, and you're an attorney, and you know what circumstantial means. Could you prove this? Could you win this case in a court of law?
Yes, I think you could.
Really?
Think you could. Yeah. I think you could.
Based on?
Well, I think first based on the witnesses, right? You have 13 eyewitnesses who say, this happened, here's when it happened, and this is what I saw. And if you don't believe the story, you have to do something with the witnesses because they're there. They're not going away. And their story is very credible, and they are credible people. I mean, one is the governor of North Carolina, Montford Stokes, who said, I saw a copy of the Mecklenburg Declaration. I held it in my hand. So he's either lying, right, which he's not, or he's confused, which you can argue. But those are really your two options. So that's the biggest single part of the evidence. Now, there's a lot of other circumstantial evidence out there. The most interesting one that I've found, which was not well known, is in the Moravian journals. And these weren't discovered till the early 20th century. But the Moravian journals— They kept track of everything. Very meticulous. You know, they would write, today it rained and the watermelons didn't come out of the ground and Brother Fred rode through town and such like that. But 100 years ago, they discover this small fragment written in German that says, oh, we should also mention for the record that in May, June, or July of 1775, Mecklenburg County declared itself free and independent of Great Britain and sent a messenger to Congress. Congress, however, declared that this was premature. So they write this. Now, here's the interesting part on this. Here's the lawyerly part on this. This is all written in German, except for the words free and independent, which they write in English. And they also use an English word declare. They said they declared independence von Great Britain. So they're obviously, if they're switching from German to English, they're obviously writing down the most literal interpretation of what they're hearing, right? So
Well, there are
that prove it. No, but that's
no. But there are several instances of things like that. You've mentioned the newspaper, and we're going to talk more about that newspaper that made its way to England with similar writings. You talk about the Moravians who keep these meticulous journals that people trust for everything else. Why not this?
Right.
Why would they put a complete lie in their journal? What would be the point of that? But there are several things like that which point to this having happened. In the face of that, why don't historians acknowledge it?
Well, I think it depends on which historians you ask. You know, and I cover this in the rest of the book. Clearly, the academic community, the traditional historical community, has been very anti the story.
But why? When you look at the Moravian journals, for instance, why wouldn't they be trusted?
Well, what the answer comes down to, you don't have a document. So we're acknowledging that something happened in Mecklenburg in May, but we think it's the Mecklenburg Resolves. We don't think it's anything like a Mecadec. It's something less important.
Mm-hmm.
You guys are overselling the story. Yes, the Met resolves happen, and those are cool, but so what? That's the claim.
Now, we have a podcast that the station produces periodically called A Trifling Place, and it gets its name from the fact that George Washington came here around the time of the Revolution, came through Charlottetown and referred to it as a trifling place.
That's right, which it was, incidentally.
and you've been interviewed for that podcast, and you can hear that podcast later today, not during this program, at your leisure by downloading it. But the trifling place moniker is underlined in your book in that you say, at the time of this meeting, in the summer, Charlotte stank of wood smoke, manure, and hogs, while in the rainy season in spring it was a mud pit, nor was it very civilized. Tell us more about our hometown.
Yeah. Hasn't changed much, has it, in certain respects? You know, it is interesting. Part of the fun for me of unraveling not only the story was learning all of this, was imagining, all right, what was it like to live here in 1770? What did somebody do? What did the place look like? What did it smell like? You know, what were the roads like? Mm-hmm. How did people live? And that to me was, and you had to get in sort of that frame of mind to even understand the background of whether this could be true or not. You know, who were these people? If this was a set of Quakers, Quakers are very nice, but if the Quakers are living here, do they have a Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence? Could the story be plausible? No, it couldn't. They had to be Scotch-Irish or something like that. Mm-hmm. They had to be people living by themselves in the woods. So Charlotte at that time is, you know, it's a dump. It's two ruddy, you know, rainy, muddy roads, one of which is right here, Tryon Street. And it is a log courthouse, and then it's a bunch of unpainted wooden homes. One or two, Hezekiah Alexander's house, for example, one or two houses are made of stone, but that's it. This is kind of the end of the road.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, so ask yourself what kind of folks are desperate, angry, or driven enough to go live here.
And there you have it. Now, writing and signing such a document, a Declaration of Independence, was an act of treason, which the founding fathers in Philadelphia pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to. The British took more than a few of them up on that. Many of them were murdered, their families lost their homes, etc. You say that the signers of the Mecklenburg Declaration made a similar pledge in their one-page document. It contained five resolutions, the third of which you quote as saying, "We do hereby declare ourselves a free and independent people, to the maintenance of which independence we solemnly pledge to each other our mutual cooperation, our lives, our fortunes, and our most sacred honor." That sounds familiar. If no document exists, how can you quote it so precisely?
Well, a document does exist. Now, the providence of this document is not clear. There is a document. So the whole foundation story is sort of broken on the world in 1819 when Joseph Alexander finds among his father's surviving old papers this document, which sets forth an account in the text of a Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't known who wrote it. It isn't known when it was written. And he says it doesn't matter. It's clearly a copy from the original records. And he publishes it in the Raleigh Register paper. And that's the story. So that's
And
that's,
you've got a photocopy of that.
And we've got a photocopy. These papers still exist. They're in Chapel Hill Library and Wilson Library. If you have ADD like I do and you want to spend your weekends driving to libraries and looking at these sorts of things, you can do that.
So who plagiarized from whom? I mean, you assert that John Adams accused Thomas Jefferson of plagiarizing the MECDEC, and you quote a letter from Adams. This is another reason why don't people believe this? If Adams has written to Reverend William Bentley of Salem, Massachusetts on July 15th, and we have the letter, and in that letter he says that he, Adams, had seen the resolutions and was so struck by the similarities that he could not help but think that Mr. Jefferson had, quote, copied the spirit, the essence, and the expressions of it verbatim. You've seen the letter?
Oh, yes.
Well, why wouldn't that be enough to make non-believers believe?
Well, you'd have to ask the non-believers. But, Adams really has a very positive and negative impact on this whole story. So Adams sees the Raleigh Register account that we just talked about, the copy in an unknown hand, it's called, the copy that no one knows where it came from. So he sees this in the paper, and he has an extraordinary response. He immediately writes a letter to Jefferson in which he says, you know, I've seen these Mecklenburg resolutions.
And people should understand that in the last years of their life, Jefferson and Adams were not friendly toward each other.
No.
Because Jefferson, there was political controversy. They had diametrically opposed ideas about how the country should run and what it should be like. Jefferson, of course, beat John Adams for a second term.
Right.
And it wasn't until later in life that they began to write each other and reconcile. So go ahead.
That's a very important point. In fact, at this point, you know, in our lives, I call them frenemies. they hadn't spoken for 10 years, and they had reconciled to some degree, and they'd been writing letters. So Adams writes this letter to Jefferson, again, who's not his buddy. And it's a very passive-aggressive, snide letter, because what it says is the genuine sense of America in these resolutions has never been so well expressed before. What does that mean? Uh-huh. Nor since. And he sort of intimates a couple times that Jefferson must have seen these Mecklenburg resolutions because they're so similar.
Could he have?
Maybe. Is there proof of it? No, there's not. There's conspiratorial views, but that does become a legitimate. And to your point, the more interesting part is Adams writes to others privately saying, Jefferson stole these. Jefferson plagiarized these.
Well, you write that there are three passages in particular that would have struck Adams as imitative of the National Declaration. In the National Declaration, it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In the MECDEC, that whoever directly or indirectly abetted or in any way, form, or manner countenanced the uncharted and dangerous invasion of our rights as claimed by Great Britain is an enemy to this country, to America, and to the inherent and inalienable rights of men.
Huzzah.
July 4th Declaration says they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. In the MECDEC, do hereby dissolve the political bands which have connected us to the mother country and hereby absolve ourselves from all allegiance to the British Crown. The Declaration of Independence, July 4th, that these united colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. In the MECDEC, do hereby declare ourselves a free and independent people, are and of right ought to be a sovereign and self-governing association. There are other things, other comparisons as well. That is so close. Somebody copied somebody.
Well, I don't think so. And I go to great.
I mean, the language. Who says "are" and "of right" ought to be?
Well, a lot of people then did. I mean, that's the part of the story that becomes a bit of a red herring. That these two documents are so similar that there must be some malfeasance. Either Jefferson stole from the MECDEC, or somebody later wrote the MECDEC while looking at the Declaration of Independence. That's not true. And if you in the last chapter of my book, I spent a lot of detail going through similar resolutions, even just through the Carolinas, that this kind of language that sounds so credible to us was really quite common.
A lot of the language of the Declaration of Independence as signed in Philadelphia was changed over the course of debate in the Continental Congress.
Right.
Things were removed. Things were added. Jefferson didn't always do all of the language. So, if a writer went from Mecklenburg County to Philadelphia to deliver this document, as it is alleged, to the Continental Congress, and the Continental Congress reads this and says, well, it's premature, and then turns around and decides a year later, it's time to do it.
Right.
Why couldn't they have borrowed the language?
Well, in theory, they could, and that is the sort of conspiratorial view on this. And to take it a step further, one of the North Carolina delegates is Joseph Hughes, who's a friend of Jefferson's.
Okay, we'll talk about that when we come back with Scott Seifert, Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Thanks for tuning in for this holiday rebroadcast edition of Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Kelso Communications, a Charlotte-based full-service marketing and advertising firm, offering the experience and tactics to help clients achieve strategic goals in a splintered communications environment. Details at kelso-communications.com. Coming up next at 10 o'clock in about 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show, Danielle Allen, Our Declaration, for the 4th of July, a fresh reading of the Declaration of Independence and how ideas of freedom and equality have been interpreted over the years. The Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10, right after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 WFAE. More Charlotte Talks in just a moment.
This week on Morning Edition, you heard Republican Senator and presidential candidate Ted Cruz say this about running a campaign.
And here's a real simple rule of thumb. If you're an arrogant little snot, you ain't gonna win.
Every day we bring you closer to the news. Listen to the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Catch Morning Edition weekdays from 5 until 9 here on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Scott Seifert, who is the co-founder of the May 20th Society, which is a group of people that celebrate MacDeck Day and who are trying to revive its celebration, which used to be much bigger than it is today, although there is one today. He's also the author of the First American Declaration of Independence, the disputed history of the Mecklenburg Declaration of May 20th, 1775, 239 years ago today. So we looked at the similarities between some of the language, mm-hmm. and I asked you if, you know, since this was allegedly delivered to the Continental Congress a year in advance of the actual of the July 4th Declaration being published, why couldn't they have borrowed and stolen some phraseology from it? And you mentioned Joseph Hughes, who was a delegate from North Carolina to the Continental Congress and a friend of Thomas Jefferson's.
So,
it'd be likely that Joseph Hughes had seen this document?
It's entirely likely he saw it. I mean, it's delivered to the North Carolina delegates by James Jack, and James Jack says, I brought it to the North Carolina delegates, and they refused to act on it. So, yes, it's entirely likely he saw it. What happens with it after that becomes unknown. And what's interesting about this is the guy that first charges Jefferson with plagiarism in the first place, of course, is John Adams. John Adams says he must have seen it. In the time of it, as you said, he's copied it verbatim. And that's a really extraordinary reaction.
And he says at some point that the document was concealed.
Yes, or hidden from me. It must have been hidden. How has it been hidden from me? And he places the blame on the North Carolina delegates, one of whom is Hughes. So in theory, yes, Joseph Hughes could have seen a copy of this. He could have kept a copy. He could have given a copy to Jefferson. All that is theoretically possible.
You know, you mentioned that James McNitt? Or
John McNitt. John McNitt,
who rode from Alexandriana to Charlotte that day for the meeting of the militia, and the result is this Declaration of Independence. And he kept the minutes of that meeting, and his papers were destroyed in April of 1800 when his house caught on fire.
That's right.
But why, if you've taken all this time to vote on this document and you're putting your life at risk because it's treason, and what they did to people who committed high treason.
Right.
Was astounding. I didn't know this till I read your book. We probably should talk about that because it's not just putting your lives and sacred honor at risk. They gutted you.
That's right. They pulled you apart in four pieces, literally.
Yeah. They hung you till you were almost dead, took you down, cut you open, pulled out your bowels, and then cut your body parts
off.
And
then burned the rest.
Yeah.
That was the sentence for high treason, according to the rules of the time.
So that was... Where was I going with
it should
this?
Be again. I don't know. Might have less treason, right?
Are you listening, Edward Snowden? where am I going with this? Well.
Got sidetracked on the murder and torture part. That always happens.
Well, I don't know where I was going. Why wouldn't there have been other copies? Why wouldn't they have had the courage of their convictions and have some printed up or hand copied out or published in some sort of newspaper that we still have copies of or that people laid their eyes on? Why? Is there this mystery involved in this that where there's nothing, there's no copy anywhere?
Right. Well, so the copies that could have existed could have been given to the North Carolina delegates, for example. And if they didn't like this, they didn't want to hear this, You know, William Hooper, for example, is one of the North Carolina delegates. And Jefferson later says of him, there was no greater Tory in Congress than Hooper. Mm-hmm. Right. So what is Hooper going to do if he receives a treasonable document like this? He's going to say thanks, but no thanks. And maybe he keeps it. Maybe he gets rid of it. There were other copies of the original records made. One was sent to a guy named William R. Davy, very famous North Carolina general. And it is found after his death, ripped in half, you know, in bad shape. But there is a fragmentary paper called the Davy copy, mm-hmm. a copy sent to a guy named Hugh Williamson, who is a congressional delegate in New York. Williamson is writing a book of the history of North Carolina. So they give him a copy and say, you should put this in your book. Of course, Williamson stops his book at 1770. So we never get that far. And what happened to all Williams' papers 20 years later? They're burned in a fire. So there are copies that are that float around like there, but are never seen again.
Plus, could it be said that contemporarily, pieces of paper like this that were written in the heat of passion
right.
were perhaps no more important to those folks than the 47,000 emails that we all get every day that we just delete without
tweets.
Reading?
Right. That's – and another thing, I mean, remember the world of 250 years ago. Paper is rare. There's no printing press in the backcountry. We're living in the woods.
Right.
Houses burn down all the time. This is not an unusual occurrence. Papers are lost. It's – you know, that's what happens to historical documents at that time, especially here. We're not living in Boston or Philadelphia. We have repositories or libraries or archives. Things just go missing.
Mm. So let's talk about Captain Jack.
Sure.
This is the man that you are responsible, you and the May 20th Society are responsible for erecting a statue of down by Central Piedmont on King's Drive. And he's on a horse and he's galloping forward in all due haste. And the reason I thought it was Paul Revere, because it reminds me of a Paul Revere statue as he rides off to warn one if by land, two if by sea, that the British are coming. He was allegedly dispatched to carry these resolves, this mech deck, to the Continental Congress.
Correct.
Now, the only evidence that Jack actually did this is a letter from the royal governor, Governor Martin, which he wrote to London saying that he had been informed, quote, that an express rider bearing certain resolves was sent from Mecklenburg to Philadelphia as soon as they were passed in the committee. Now, he used the word resolve.
Right.
And in the mech deck, there are three or four resolves, but how do we know he's not talking about the Mecklenburg resolves, which are a different document?
That's the controversy in a nutshell. You mentioned that the ride of Jack is evidenced by, you know, that letter. There's actually a ton of evidence that Jack went to Philadelphia. The Moravians, again, mention it, that a guy from Mecklenburg riding express to Philadelphia has passed through. Later witnesses attest to it, so I think Jack's ride is not in controversy. You can ask even the most anti-mech deck person. Jack definitely rode there. The question is, what was he carrying?
Mm-hmm.
And your point is exactly right, which is you can make the argument that everything we know about it is equally consistent with carrying the Mecklenburg resolves as opposed to the Mecklenburg.
Now, in 1775,
yep.
Were we at war with Britain at that? Not really.
Not really.
There were skirmishes.
Well, we had the battles of Lexington and Concord,
right.
of course.
But there were skirmishes.
But yes,
we had not.
That's right.
So would he have been stopped on the road? If the British had wanted to, could they have stopped him, searched his papers? Would that have been a dangerous ride for him?
That would have been a dangerous ride for him. In fact, you know, and I mentioned this in the book, people that are going to visit Governor Martin, actually on the coast, are stopped by Whig patriots and searched for papers like this. And he complains about him. He said, I can't get any messages from anybody,
mm-hmm.
you know, in July of 1775, because all these militia people are stopping people. So that's very common.
So who is this Captain Jack?
Well, you know, we don't.
Why was he chosen to make this ride, and who is he?
Well, we don't know that much about him, which is a bit of a shame. I mean, we know he was a tavern owner. He was his descendancy was from Ireland. His parents owned a tavern called Pat Jack's Tavern on Trade Street, and he was obviously well regarded or regarded enough to be a the messenger. Now, why was he chosen? Who knows? Was he going to Philadelphia anyway? Was he less well known than some of these guys like McNitt Alexander, Waite Stillavery, or Brevard, who are pretty well known as patriotic leaders? Are they more likely to get stopped mm-hmm. than a Jack? That could be the explanation.
So he goes to Philadelphia allegedly to deliver the mech deck to members of the Continental
yep.
Congress, which somebody somewhere says that's premature.
Right.
That indicates that somebody somewhere saw this document.
That's exactly what it indicates.
And do we have in written form somebody saying that this is premature?
Yes. But what we have are the fragmentary notes of McNitt Alexander and others accounting to that story.
So it's nobody from the Continental
them.
Congress.
No.
It's people saying it was received, but they said no.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So there's no evidence. There's no written commentary
right.
about Captain Jack's arrival in Philadelphia or any contact that he might have had with any member of the Continental
Other than
Congress.
His own account of it and sort of the people in Charlotte talking about it after the fact, no, that is absolutely right.
But that's not the only time that the royal governor of North Carolina spoke of or wrote about the Mecklenburg Declaration.
Right.
It's not the only time that just because of Captain Jack. You quote several of his writings. Where did you find them?
So these are all in the colonial records, which are the all the existing records of old colonial North Carolina, and these are minutes kept by the of the governor's meetings, you know, on of his cabinet. They'd call a cabinet meeting, just like Governor Curry would these days, except without the wigs. And everyone would sit there and
We don't know that.
We're speculating again. But they would have a meeting and they would say, you know, what do we need to deal with? And he'd say, well, first thing we've got to deal with is Mecklenburg County. They've passed these treasonable resolutions. What do we do? And there are three or four instances of that in the summer of 1775, as power is leaking out of his hands, really, and he's forced to get on a ship in the Cape Fear River and really never set foot in the state again.
Mm-hmm.
So the colony is falling apart around him at this time, but he specifically does mention Mecklenburg County in several publications.
So things were getting rough for the British here.
Yes.
Despite whether or not the Declaration
That's
of Mecklenburg
exactly right.
exists. And it was all contemporaneous with that declaration.
That's right.
Because things were getting rough around the country.
Yeah.
But we don't think of North Carolina as being the hotbed of the American Revolution. We think of it as being Boston.
Well, I do.
Lexington and Concord and Yorktown and places like that. Why North Carolina? Why such a hotbed here?
Well, we're working on that perception. But what happens is, especially after the war, you have this all the various states pushed to claim primacy in the American Revolution. And the people from Virginia say, the American Revolution starts with us. It's Jefferson, it's Patrick Henry. We did the whole thing. And the Massachusetts folks say, no, it was all fought up here. And everybody sort of wants to claim that they were the leaders in the whole thing. And to some degree, that history really becomes normal modern Revolutionary War history by which, you know, even historians today will say this started in Boston. There was a bunch of stuff that happened around New York. And then Yorktown happens. When in fact, you know, for 4 years, you know, the British are marching through Charlotte. They're fighting at Camden, Cowpens, Kings Mountain,
right.
Major battles, but they're overshadowed because they're not in big towns.
And don't forget Francis Marion and the Swamp Fox in South Carolina.
Swamp Fox.
Let me share some emails. Gary emails, could you address the key piece of evidence that local officials in both Rowan and Mecklenburg counties used in 1775 as the date of their independence for the court minutes well into the early 1800s? Also, that letters written in the same period used the same reference point. More importantly is the background of Alexander Craighead as the resident ideologue of the 1760s, as what was taught in the Presbyterian churches was a Scottish covenanter mentality that was the basis for the whole argument. Thus, Gary Will's theory about Jefferson and the Scottish Enlightenment is in part proves that Mec. I'm just reading what he's written here. In part, proves
I think
that
this is a friend of mine.
The Mec deck had a role in the shaping of the ideas of the 1776 Declaration.
Yeah, so this is what I do now. So first on the court minutes, what he's referring to is a really cool piece of evidence, which is if you go back to the court records of 1774, 1775 deeds, bills of trust, that sort of stuff. Yep. A lot of them, or after, will say. In 1780, for example, they will say, this is the fifth year of our independence. Or in 1777, they will say, 2 years since we've declared independence. So if you're of a certain mentality, you will think, this proves that they believe that in 1775, we declared independence. They're dating it not from 1776, but from 1775. Now, the problem with that very interesting and cool argument is there's a bunch of deeds that are all over the place. And you have some that date it 1777, and you have some that date them 1774. So if you're being scrupulous about the evidence, that to me cannot in itself prove by it's it means something, but it doesn't mean as much as people would like. The other one is Alexander Craighead. He is a fascinating character. I've got a whole book on Alexander Craighead, or a whole chapter in the book on Craighead. He is the leading covenanter, which is a sort of militant Scottish brand of Presbyterians,
mm-hmm.
very anti-English. You know, these guys held their swords over their head while they preached. I mean, the old school fire and brimstone preacher. And he was the leader of the community. So that tells you something about the mentality of the people that were living here.
Gretchen emails, I have a page from the 1876 Harper's Weekly announcing the Mecklenburg Declaration. It mentions that Charlotte is strategically located on Sugar Creek.
That's
Bill
right.
And Matthews emails, it seems like the largest part of the controversy is not over the existence of the document, but rather over whether or not it was ever delivered to those in power at the time. So theoretically, this document was delivered to the Continental Congress by Captain James Jackson, but no record exists of that
right.
delivery. Presumably, it made it to London, but no evidence of that exists. There is also no evidence of the document in the personal papers of the signers. How can that be? And doesn't the lack of physical evidence in so many different places add up to the logical conclusion that it never existed?
No.
You're a true believer, and there's no deterring you.
Your point is the evidence is very mixed, and that you're 100% correct. There is a body of evidence. It can be interpreted one of two ways. If you want to have that interpretation, there's a segment of people in society and in the historical community especially that unless McNitt Alexander rises from the grave uh-huh. with a signed copy that's time-stamped May 20th.
It could
They're
happen.
Not going to believe it. And that's fine.
It could happen.
It could happen. So we're cool with that. You know, we're not in the historical controversy business. We're in the, let's just talk about the fun of it business.
Now, there is allegedly a copy of the Cape Fear Mercury newspaper from June of 1775 that contained
yes.
the Mech Deck. That paper was placed in the British Public Records Office in London. However, it is missing and has been for quite a while. What do you know about that?
So this ties into the did Jefferson plagiarize from the Mech Deck? Could you prove it argument? So a copy is sent by the British governor to London, and he says the resolves of the Mecklenburg are in this newspaper, right? Mm-hmm. So in the 1840s, historians go to London to find the newspaper. Mm-hmm. And in the records, they find the letter, but the newspaper's gone. And instead of the newspaper is a piece of paper that says paper has been removed at the express instructions of Andrew Stevenson. Well, who's Stevenson? So Stevenson is the U.S. ambassador to Great Britain. Stevenson is from Virginia. Stevenson is a friend and political adversary of, or ally of, Thomas Jefferson. After Stevenson's stint in London, he goes home and becomes the head of UVA. So what does this prove? Who knows? But it is at least curious that the definitive proof that could be somewhere is removed from a guy from Virginia who's intimate with the controversy and with the leading actors, and the paper's never seen again.
So he's pulled this paper, and the late fees on it must be astronomical.
You've got to be unbelievable. That's right.
So we don't really know what was in that
paper. We have no idea. It's all
speculation. We know that he took it out. He borrowed it and never returned it.
Well, we know that the governor described it as horrid and treasonable resolutions. We just don't know what the text of those resolutions
now, Cokie Rock.